Thank you, Sreeni. Nice to be here. From the looks of the program, I wish I was here longer, but didn't work out for me. So what I'm going to talk about today is phenomenological observations of the structure of wall turbulence. I understand that there are people here who live, eat, and breathe wall turbulence, and there are people here who maybe don't, so I'll just say a few words about background. I want to first off acknowledge my co-workers. The work I'm going to present has actually been going on for about 10 years, and so it's a combination of some work from Carl Meinhardt's PhD thesis and Chris Thompson's master's thesis and Jake and Joe's PhD thesis, and then Zichao Liu and Siva Balachandra are my colleagues who are doing computations. And I have left copies of a couple of reports that describe much of the work, and as we discussed before the meeting began, I will send more reports if asked to do
if
so.
If anyone wants those reports, please let me know.
Okay, so when you look at wall turbulence, here's a couple of flow visualizations of it. These are both boundary layers visualized with smoke, and flow is from left to right. And what you see are there's some large structures that are whose size is of the order of the thickness of the boundary layer, and whose length is maybe two times that thickness. But then there's, of course, a lot of small-scale structure as well. And one of the messages I'll be carrying today is that because this sort of flow is inhomogeneous, it's a situation in which small-scale structures form and then create larger scale structures, so there is a building process, unlike the usual picture of turbulence breaking down in an energy cascade from larger to smaller scales. Here the large scales are created by the small scales. Okay. And now there can be a cascade within this once the large scales are created. They can also break down and you can have an energy cascade as well, but this process of forming large out of small is inherent. So it's fully three-dimensional, and it's because of the inhomogeneity. The extreme case, which I'll allude to, is the atmosphere, where you might start with eddies that are a few, millimeters to centimeters in size at the ground, and then they grow to be hundreds of meters in size. Okay. Now, some years ago, but this is just because the channel flow is low Reynolds number. If it's high Reynolds number, the difference would be enormous, just the same as in the atmosphere. You're right. In the y direction, in the direction perpendicular to the wall. Yeah, so it's in a channel flow, it would be homogeneous in the x direction and in the z direction, whereas in a boundary layer, it would be weakly inhomogeneous in the x direction. But it's the wall normal direction that's important in determining the scaling. So some years ago, Steve Robinson made an effort to try and assemble all the different things that we know about wall turbulence into coherent picture, no pun intended. And okay, do you have a pointer here that I can? Yeah. All right. Sure. The what? No, I don't think so. But I have pictures of them. I have a picture of a chicken neck. Yeah. So. But anyway, this is just to sort of give you a feeling, if you're not familiar with the area, of all the different anatomical elements that people have observed in wall turbulence. And there's probably about a dozen different features that are accepted as being important in wall turbulence, but not necessarily connected in any way. So bursts and ejections and sweeps and are the most widely cited, but then there are many others as well, which you can read here. And so the one of the questions that I think is important is how can one integrate all of these different observations into a single paradigm? And then the other thing that I think is important is that one of the most important aspects of turbulence is the logarithmic layer. Of course, that's been a subject of hot debate recently, but then the question is, what is the structure of the logarithmic layer? What is the characteristic geometry of the eddies in it? So, again, for those of you who don't normally work in wall turbulence, let me just define a few things. The friction velocity is the square root of the wall shear stress over density, and the viscous link scale is nu over the friction velocity. And the thing that's most handily referred to is the Karman number, which is the boundary layer thickness over the friction velocity. So it just tells you the ratio of the largest link scale to the smallest link scale. Now, most of the experimental results were obtained using particle image velocimetry, and there are experiments in which we use a thin light sheet observe the instantaneous velocity vector fields, typically with about a resolution of 100 by 100 grid points. And that, in our case, is done in a wind tunnel using 1 micron oil droplets as seed particles. The measurements are done. It's homogeneous, so the distribution of particles, I mean, the mean concentration is uniform.
No. I mean, if you take little areas and count the number of particles in them.
Yes.
What is the distribution?
It'd be a Poisson distribution.
Poisson?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, they're small enough so there's no exclusion of particle volumes. They're 1 micron particles, and you're typically dealing with 1 cubic millimeter, so you're talking about concentrations of 1 part in 10 to the 8th, so there's no exclusionary property. Okay. They are 800 times denser than the fluid, but they're so small that the frequency response of the 1 micron particle is something like 50 kilohertz in air, whereas the accelerations are much slower than that. So they follow the flow extremely well. Okay. So for the low Reynolds number case that I'll be showing you, we're looking at a Reynolds number of about 1,000. There's a couple different experiments, but they're nearly the same in Reynolds number. And the Karman number is about 400. Okay, so the boundary layer thickness is 400 viscous wall units tall, whereas in the high Reynolds number case, it's about 2,000. Okay, and that is high enough Reynolds number to be considered a respectable turbulent boundary layer in the laboratory, but it's certainly not what would be considered a very high Reynolds number boundary layer. Most of the laboratory boundary layers, I suppose about the highest ones you'd typically find would have RE thetas of about 3 times this, around 20,000. Okay. And now, of course, people are trying to go to much higher Reynolds numbers. Yeah, sure. Okay. Got it? Okay. So, okay. Now, one of the ideas that's been around for a long time in boundary layers is the hairpin vortex. And this started with Theodorsen. And I've cited a few of the principal advocates. And although the hairpin vortex has been around for 50 years as a concept, I think you could still find lots of people who doubt it or even reject it as a concept. Even Robinson in his review papers stopped short of actually saying that what he saw constituted hairpin vortices. And in fact, I can show you a picture of that in his article. You'll find a diagram like this, where he shows what he observed, and what he observed in three-dimensional direct numerical simulations with close to the wall quasi-streamwise vortices, far away from the wall in the wake region, large arches, and in the logarithmic layer he saw combinations of the two, which if you expanded that would look something like this. But he stopped short, well, you can see here he called it an arch or a horseshoe, but he never really wanted to use the term hairpin vortex and say that that was what he was. He didn't want to connect the legs and the arch into a single entity. One of the things that I'm going to say today is that we actually see extensive evidence for hairpin vortices, and they're not easy to see in without looking carefully, but this is a typical example of data where you see the following elements: a relatively circular circulation region that looks like a cross section through a vortex, a region of low momentum fluid being pumped upwards, in other words, a second quadrant in the UV plane event. It's inclined at about 45 degrees, and then there's a stagnation point region where you have a fourth quadrant event, high momentum fluid coming down, stagnating against the second quadrant event, and then a shear layer here. You get all these elements put together, which if you do pattern recognition, that's quite a few different telltales, and they're all consistent with the idea that you have a hairpin vortex in which the laser light sheet that recorded those data was cutting through the mid, somewhere between the legs of the hairpin. And so here's the head. The hairpin by vortex induction is inducing flow at approximately 90 degrees to the plane of this vortex. And so that's the Q2 event. Because the vortex will propagate just like a smoke ring would propagate backward, it has a relative velocity to the surrounding fluid, so you tend to see in the right frame of reference a Q4 event approaching it, and you get this inclined shear layer and a stagnation point. And then very close to the wall, you have the legs inducing low momentum fluid up from the wall, producing these large, long regions of low speed momentum. This hairpin, the flow is in the X direction, Y is perpendicular to the wall. This hairpin, as I tried to sketch it, is at about 45 degrees to the X direction, okay? And it need not be symmetric. That it could be sort of a one-legged thing.
What is the estimation
around the hairpin? I don't know the number on that. I'd have to check that. Okay. So this is a summary of those characteristics if you look just in the XY plane, and they actually coincide quite well with what we see here, for example. And if you look at this data and you look at the sketch, let's see, I'll lift this up a little bit like that. Okay. So, in fact, when we look at experimental data, we see hundreds and thousands of these things. In fact, I can guarantee you there is no experimental image that we've ever taken where we didn't see one, at least one and perhaps a dozen. Okay. Now, well, I don't... You know, the thing is, how do you define the volume of something that's gradually tapering off? You tell me that, and then I'll give you an estimate. Okay. No, what we can say is you know, what, how many per unit area you see, how many characteristic signatures per unit area. And roughly speaking, close to the wall, for example, you see one of these every few hundred viscous wall units. Okay. Now they grow as you go outward, so you see fewer of them as you go away from the wall in proportion to Y. All right. And they become bigger, and they're, the reasons I hesitated on the circulation is because that may change also. So that's one thing there seems to be pretty good evidence for the existence of the hairpins. And later on, I'll show you some three-dimensional direct numerical simulations that show them quite clearly as well. And so you don't.
In case where delta plus is like 400.
This is a low Reynolds number. That's right. This is, but at high Reynolds number, you'll see some examples later too. Now the other thing that comes up is that you see, in this case, the hairpins appeared in a group. Okay. And in fact, that happens quite regularly also. So I'll refer to that not as, as the hairpin packet paradigm. And it's the idea that, you don't just see randomly scattered hairpins as you would find, for example, in models of Perry and colleagues who synthesize boundary layers out of hairpins and assume that they're a random point process. But instead, they actually have a coherent organization amongst them. And it's this organization that actually explains how it is that in the buffer layer and above, you see, it may explain why you see long streaks in the buffer layer. The hairpins themselves are regions that are about 100 to 200 viscous wall units long, and they create streaks that are about that long. But then we observe experimentally that in fact these low-speed streaks are much longer than that, several thousand viscous wall units. Fosley will have a different explanation for that, and so I don't think it's necessary to say which one of those is exclusively the only source. In fact, they may be tied together in some way we don't fully understand yet. But then further away from the wall, there are very long regions that have been observed and never explained by any model of the wall layer. And they are tens of thousands of viscous wall units long. And this packet paradigm explains that by simply saying that these streaks are created by many hairpin vortices aligning. It also relates to some observations that Sirovich and co-workers have made in terms of the structure of the proper orthogonal decomposition modes of wall turbulence. And many of the other events, such as the Vita event, which is a Q4 here, Q2, Q4 combination, have to do with the succession of one hairpin after another. So now I'm going to go through and explain some of these things. Here's just a different picture to show you what we're typically looking at in wall turbulence. Now this is only going up to about half the boundary layer height, and again it's a low Reynolds number case. But you can see here that you tend to see a tall vortex and then some lower one before and aft, and they all have approximately 45 degrees. It varies, that angle varies, let's say from 30 to 60 degrees. So it looks like a primary and then an upstream and a downstream vortex and so on. Now, why is it a packet? Well, it's a packet simply because all of these vortices are propagating at the same velocity. Okay? We've done measurements of that, and the dispersion, velocity dispersion within a packet is about 7% RMS. Okay? So they tend to have a very long lifetime. Oh yeah. This is that's right. Depending on what we find is that these packets or the primary hairpin will first form ahead somewhere around 50 to 100 viscous wall units above the wall. Okay? Then this grows after that. Okay. So at low Reynolds number, which this is, it turns out that delta plus here is 400, so 0.1 is 40. So this is the first layer of hairpins at this Reynolds number. But if this was the atmosphere, you know, this would be the first centimeter, and then you've got hundreds of meters to go in which you still see these things.
The circle-looking things are velocity vectors in
These are just the instantaneous velocity vectors, and the circles are just drawn in to bring your eye's attention to them. Yeah. And likewise with the lines, those are just... Right. Now, one of the consequences of the alignment of the hairpins is that they create regions of uniform momentum. These are contours of uniform velocity. And you can see the light gray shaded region is the contour within this one packet we were looking at. And the momentum is fairly uniform throughout this region. Now, it's streamwise momentum, yeah, the U component of momentum. If I laid this on top, okay, you could see the packet clearly there, and then just the contours of momentum. If you look at the instantaneous velocity profiles in the y direction, these are just profiles. These squares are streamwise velocity as a function of height. And you can see it's relatively constant at the free stream velocity out here, and then it drops down in this region too. And then when it crosses this line here, there's a rapid shear, and then it's relatively constant in this region, so on. Okay. Now, when I say relatively constant, what do I mean? If you do a histogram of the velocity vectors, you find these sorts of bumps, and these bumps correspond to these different zones that I identified. So the free stream is out here at 1, and then zone 3 has this maximum, and so on. Well, what you see is that if you look at the modal velocities, location of maximum probability, the distance between them is somewhat wider than the width of the distribution. So that's what I mean by relatively uniform, is that this spread is rather smaller than the distance between them, so you can actually distinguish these different zones of uniform momentum. How many structures? Oh, this is just one. This is just one. Now, if you took many, if you did the usual thing, which would be to do a large ensemble average, and you took many of these, what you'd get is something that was smooth and went like this, because these location of these maxima are moving around. So they're modulated randomly. But if I, for example, show you enough of these, what you would see is that, let me just show you one other to illustrate the point. If I can find it. Yeah, here's another one. Okay. You see this over and over again every time. Okay. Yes. Yeah. That's right. It's very close to the free stream velocity. Well, no.
No.
One is free stream right here. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm reading it wrong.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it. In I labeled them here. Okay, zone 1 was this area under this first group of hairpins. Zone 2, you can tell just by looking at the darkness here, these vectors are long in the negative direction, so they're painting over one another, making a dark region. That's low momentum. Most of the vectors in this zone 2 are traveling at the convection velocity that we're using here, which is 80% of free stream, so they look pretty light. And then in zone 3, they're positive vectors, and they look somewhat dark again. So these are the different zones.
What's your algorithm for drawing the lines between the
two? It's just a contour line. Okay. But you have to choose the right contour to hit it.
Yes. Yeah. And how do you decide on fine date of the convecting
We systematically look at all of convection velocities. We scan through it like you do with a spectrum analyzer. Okay? Yeah, you could. That's one of the keys. Yeah. Okay. What happens as you look at a circular vortex and you change the convection velocity? I mean, you can imagine adding a large enough convection velocity, so all you'd see is a shear, right? You wouldn't see anything at all. So what happens is that. As you change the convection velocity, you'll find a certain convection velocity, which you get a very clear circular pattern. Not only that, but then it turns out this Q2 event comes through very clearly, and it has the right angle. Okay. And then as you change the velocity, eventually that circular pattern actually seems to move up or down, depending on which way you're going. And then it eventually gets distorted enough, so it just looks like a little wave, and then it disappears. I've managed to. This one? Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good example. In this frame of reference at 80% view infinity, if you look right here, you don't see anything. But if you change to 92% U infinity, then you see a nice vortex. Yeah, exactly. And that's why when we're looking at these fields, we just scan through all the different convection velocities so we can get it good. Now, it turns out...
Is that the residual of some very old structure there?
This one here? I think this is...
Go up on the upper corner. Yeah, right there.
Up here?
Yeah, is that something left there?
That's getting... There's something that goes on in the outer region here that's different from... It's in addition to what I'm talking about down here, and I don't fully understand it. It could be, but I don't want to. I really don't want to get pinned down on that. Okay. No? In fact, there it is. Okay. So this is a later experiment. One of the problems with this data I was just showing you is it was only 1.2 boundary layer thicknesses long, and we really couldn't see the full structure. So we did another experiment where we had three boundary layer thicknesses, and now we could see the full structure. And this is vorticity color contoured in, and what you see is a pattern. This square sort of outlines what we were able to see in the previous data. Or the field of view that we could see, and same sort of picture, inclined region, heads of hairpins, now indicated by the intense vorticity, and if you look at these carefully, it's pretty small scale. Well, this is blown up here, but say you look at one of these heads like this right here, now you see the Q2 event, stagnation point, Q4 event, but now look at the Q4 events really occurring because of the induction from this upstream. Head moving fluid down towards it. So this is why I say the Q2, Q4 event, which is also the Vita interaction, is actually associated with these successive hairpins. But the main thing you see is this interesting structure, which has about a 10 to 15 degree slope. And it looks like a ramp, okay? And then it drops down and starts to grow again. So you can see succession of a large number of hairpins in one of these packets. In fact, we don't always see this. This is a prime example. Sometimes it's a lot more complicated. But we often see this, and then we often see that these are included in the environment of another larger structure, which you see up here. So the idea that these different momentum zones, uniform momentum zones, are actually the interiors of packets of the hairpins, okay? And why are they uniform momentum? Because the vortices in the packets are coherently inducing backflow, and so it's like a solenoid, like the windings on a solenoid, and you get a nice intense backflow just like you intensify the magnetic flux inside of a solenoid. Now, these angles, these growth angles, are important, and here's a histogram of it. It's 13 degrees, plus or minus 6, so there's a fair variance around that mean angle. But okay, what I mean by that is if you take this boundary for the low momentum region and just take the angle of that, okay? The 45 degrees, see, that's why structure of boundary layer has been difficult. The 45 degrees has to do with the slope of the legs of the hairpin. The 11 or to 15 degrees is the rate or the angle of the locus of the heads of the hairpins. Okay. Now, the question. Yeah. Well, it is and it isn't. When you look at the growth of an individual hairpin, it turns out to grow at a shallow angle, and then it gradually, by its own self-induction, it keeps getting steeper and steeper. It can go up to 90 degrees. It really depends on the environment or the shear flow that it finds itself in. So people have made simple-minded arguments about maximum strain, but that's all based on the assumption that there's just a uniform shear of some known velocity. And I think that's not the case here, because these hairpins are growing up in the environment of larger hairpins. The larger hairpins are in the environment of still larger hairpins, so it's a more complicated.
Do you see 45 because that is when they are most strong?
Well, I think that you tend to see the 45, it's a phase of their growth, okay? And it also turns out that if you look at a single hairpin, it'll grow and eventually it might get up to 90. But what I'm showing you here is actually the genesis of a hairpin packet, and which may come to answer your question. Here's the primary hairpin. We started out with a simple disturbance that was a conditional average given a Q2 event. Let it grow and it developed into a hairpin, but then during the course of its growth, it spawned a new hairpin back here. This hairpin you see is spawning another new hairpin over here. And then the primary hairpin also spawned a downstream hairpin. So in other words, it's an aspect of the disturbance that it's able to auto-generate new hairpins and create these, you get these long packets because of the generation mechanism. Now, this is a low Reynolds number computation, and so it strictly doesn't pertain to the observations which we have, which are both at low Reynolds number and high Reynolds number.
May I make a comment?
Yeah.
This 45 degree is a reasonable assumption, but I think it does not take into account the self-dynamics and the self-induction. These are pretty energetic forces, so they will always play into this cup because of the self-induction, and so therefore 45 degrees do not need to give them an energy.
The thing I wanted to come to here is that when you get a upstream vortex spawned, it starts inducing flow down, which actually keeps this from going up to the 90 degrees. So if it's an isolated vortex by itself, it eventually curls up, goes to 90 degrees. But when new vortices form behind it, they keep pushing it down.
Even 45 degrees is not
good
for passive
elements. Yeah. So,
45. Yeah.
It really is a complicated thing, because if this thing formed further behind, I mean, instead of forming here, if it formed back here, this might act like an isolated vortex. Its interaction would be so weak that it would do just what Tony said. So I don't think it's a simple explanation. You have to decide why this one starts to form where it does and how strong it will be and so on. So. But the interesting thing is that the computations come up with hairpins that grow along the same angle, about 12, 13 degrees. Okay, so this is the sort of natural growth of.
Depending on the
Chuck only had two vortices, so it was really difficult for him to say for sure, but that angle is consistent. Okay.
Some years ago, one of the mysteries locally active symmetric circle was a thing that just went in the direction of the preferred direction.
Yeah. I think one of the things I should mention here is you notice that the legs, which are parallel to the wall or nearly parallel to the wall, are also spawning vortices which are nearly parallel to the wall. This may relate to some of Fosley's ideas, but you see them all over here. So there's Brooke and Hanratty have identified a mechanism that looks very much like this. So there is a possibility of forming new vortex loops, and then there's also streamwise vorticity being formed as well.
Ron, how could you decide which is a primary vortex and which are the vortices?
We simply track it in time. In fact, this is the initial structure that we started with. This is the conditional average of the velocity field given the second quadrant event here, which is taken from the probability density for UV, and so that's the initial condition for this numerical solution. Okay, and then in time it grows up to be a single hairpin like this, and then at later time it starts to spawn these additional ones. So we can just track it in time. Yeah. So the idea here was that you can't see these things in the fully turbulent simulations because it's just too messy. So you do it in a clean environment and look at the dynamics that way. No, it occurs both upstream and downstream. This is a picture of how the secondary hairpin gets generated. The high curvature in the XY plane in here causes these legs to loop up and come together, and when they come together you get a region of enhanced upward motion, sort of a local jet of fluid that comes up, and then shown here, it runs into the high-speed fluid and wraps up into a vortex head, which then seems to come down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, both. Yeah. Both, at a certain point, both mechanisms are comparable. At different times, one is stronger than the other. That's right. So, now one of the things that's been observed is that you don't actually have symmetric hairpins very often. This is a picture of what happens if you start with a symmetric disturbance. Of course, you get symmetric hairpins. Eventually, numerical noise will break that symmetry, but you get a downstream as well as an upstream hairpin. Now, if you start with an asymmetric hairpin, something that looks like a cane or a one-legged hairpin, then you tend to get one-legged hairpins generated like that. And this looks, again, similar to something that Britter and Fosley and have seen in the very near wall region. Okay. Turns out, if you look at this, these form much more rapidly. Here there's only 220 wall units between the primary and the secondary, whereas here it's 340 at the same time. So these are really growing more rapidly, and that could explain why they're seen much more often. Okay, now, What is interesting here is that these things weren't seen in direct numerical simulations, which are three-dimensional and give you any quantity you want. And the question is why? That seems very reasonable. But I remember going out to Stanford in '87 and wandering through vector fields for a couple months and never found anything that I could really interpret. And yet, when we go now to the data, direct numerical simulation of a channel flow, and we visualize it the way we've been visualizing the experimental data, well, there it is. In fact, it's all over the place. This is 1/16 of a cube of the volume, and it shows up very clearly. So I think part of the reason is that it's this business about having a template in your mind. You know, you can't do template matching until you have a template to work with. So you have to know what you're looking for, and then you can see it. But here you can see these hairpin heads lined up along an angle that's, in this case, 12 degrees. And I think the pockets that Falco talked about would be just these Q2 regions coming up, but the interactions he talked about vortices coming down to the wall and interacting, I couldn't claim to have seen anything like that. No.
Well, Rob, do I interpret correctly that you went back now to the
Yep. I think so. I mean, those computations were our own, but actually we've done it in a couple different computations. And here again, here's a three-dimensional visualization of it. And I think this also shows why it's hard to see. This is a very small sub-volume of a large computation. But it's typical. If I picked out another sub-volume, I'd see something quite like this. And we've highlighted the vortices here so you can see the packet. And you can see there's a lot of debris, a lot of small-scale chopped-up vorticity. And if you just look at this without the highlighting, you'd be hard-pressed to see the hairpins, okay? Especially if you weren't looking for it. The other thing is that we're not using vorticity here. We're using an eigenvalue of the velocity gradient tensor. It's similar in spirit to the lambda 2 eigenvalue that Fosley uses, but somewhat different mathematically. And that gets rid of the mean shear and lets you just look at the component of the velocity field that has to do with local rotation. It's all, these are contours of this, so they're all the same intensity. Yeah. And you notice they're also about the same size. The core diameter is about the same. Where does the debris come from? Well, we've done computations with a, which I don't have with me, unfortunately, but we've done computations for longer periods of time with single vortices, and what we find is that even a single asymmetric vortex ultimately devolves into something like this. In other words, there are enough interactions, even starting with a simple structure, that it begins to look like a very cluttered and field with lots of small-scale debris. Okay. So they're well, the whole volume is a couple thousand, yeah. So this is just a section. Yeah, I'll show you a bigger volume later on. Okay, so then there's the question about what happens at higher Reynolds numbers. Well, if you take typical channel flow computations like Kim Moser and Moyne, it was RETEL 180. This is 150, and there's really only room for one hairpin packet to grow, and then it runs into the other wall. Okay, so this is the effective Reynolds number. But if you go to higher Reynolds numbers, what happens is that you get room for older packets. So here's a young packet down here, which is highlighted, and then out here along this line, you can see a large hairpin loop, and then there's another one in here like this, and another one back here. So this is an older packet. Okay. That's artificial accentuation. Yeah, in other words, we're using our own intelligence to do it. This is just a side view of the same thing. And the idea is that at a given Y location now, what you tend to see is the larger hairpins. Okay? Now, those larger hairpins are also older hairpins that started out growing far upstream. The fact that at a given Y location you see larger hairpins, that's just Townsend's attached eddy hypothesis, or another way of stating it. But so, in fact, you don't see the young hairpins from this packet at all at a given Y location and above. So the idea is that the outer parts of the boundary layer, as you go away from the wall, are all older upstream stuff, and it's only very near the wall that you have locally generated hairpins. So one of the complexities of non-uniform boundary layers, let's say non-equilibrium boundary layers, is that suppose there's something different going on up here, some different roughness or pressure gradient. What you see at a given location is actually inherited from far upstream. Okay, so it feels a full history of the boundary layer, whereas very close to the wall, that's local. So if the roughness went from, let's say, smooth to rough, this packet would be responding to the roughness, but this one would not be. Okay. So the simple model then that I want to conclude with is something like this: that the vortices appear in packets. There's a reason for them to auto-generate. The packets grow in a sort of continuous fashion. Eventually, they have to run into each other from the side. They have to, if they're going to fill the boundary layer on a large scale, there has to be fewer of them when you go far away from the wall. So there's a pairing mechanism, which I'm not going to have time to talk about today, but there's a way in which the packets, two packets come together to form a larger packet. So sometimes when you see a larger packet, it's just one that's been growing for a while. Other times it's actually grown and then paired. But the net effect is you get still larger packets and then still larger packets in a hierarchy. And that hierarchy creates these uniform momentum zones. Now, the evidence on which that model is based is direct numerical simulation, which is quite low Reynolds number, and laboratory simulations, which are, I would say, moderate Reynolds number. Okay. And the question is, what happens in the limit of infinite Reynolds number? We did an experiment last fall on the Bonneville Salt Flats at Dugway Proving Ground, where it was just a simple flow visualization experiment. But this is an experiment where the RE theta is 10 to the 7th, almost 10 to the 7th. So it's four orders of magnitude larger than our laboratory experiments. And you can see that we see these ramp-like structures in the flow visualization that look much like the ramps that we see in the much lower Reynolds number experiments. This was with fine smoke. That's right. Yeah. One time, I have one slide which isn't with me of a rattlesnake in the experimental domain. He was actually under a, so he didn't cause any problems. From a theoretical viewpoint, I think this, the alignment of the vortices has one easily explained but significant consequence, and that's shown here. I alluded to a solenoid inducing a strong magnetic field in its interior, and these aligned vortices also induce strong backflows. And one way to appreciate that is to just take a simple model in which you sum up the induced fields of these different vortices. So bold use of alpha as the vector field from hairpin alpha, and then calculate the Reynolds stress. Well, of course, this is just linear. I'm not even worried about nonlinear interactions or anything else, but the Reynolds stress is nonlinear. So when you calculate the Reynolds stress associated with a packet of hairpins, you get one term, which is a sum of the Reynolds stresses from each hairpin, But then you get another term, which is a summation of cross terms, okay? In optics, of course, this would be the coherent term. If you have coherent alignment, so that this average doesn't reduce to zero, then you'd pick up this term if you had coherent light, whereas you'd only get this term if it was incoherent light. So, and we've done some evaluations of how big this coherent term is, and it turns out, depending on the spacing of the vortices, it can go up to 400 or 500% of this other term. So, again, depending on the spacing, it can be the dominant source of Reynolds stress in the boundary layer. Okay.
Is it safe to say there's only important
ones
removed
that are separated from the wall? Yeah.
Is this the difference between
them and the color? The buffer layer is really just this region where the legs are parallel to the wall, and you have quasi-streamwise vorticity. That goes up to about y plus of 30 or 50, something like that. The head is above that. Okay, so yes. Okay. Now, whether or not the length of the low-speed streaks in the buffer layer is a result of the alignment of the hairpins, or a result of something else, which I'm sure Fosley would like to say it's a result of an instability, that I think is something that just needs exploration. It could be both, again, just nature and its complexity. But this just shows a single hairpin, and the red is the Reynolds stress region. You can see you're getting both high Reynolds stress here under the head and also between the legs, okay? And then if you look at a packet of hairpins, if you look at a longer scale region, this is just showing you what I was talking about in that equation, here we have the packet of hairpins in red, and then the blue is the Reynolds stress, and you can see that it's extended across between several hairpins. And then that is associated with a long low momentum streak as well. Okay, yeah, the red here is the indication of the vortex core here and here, and the blue, is that purple? I'm colorblind, so I have to be careful. Neither can I. So, okay. So, now, there's one other thing I want to mention. I probably should stop very quickly, but if one does proper orthogonal decomposition and evaluates the modes that contribute to the Reynolds stresses, you get an interesting result. I want to give a little history on this first. If you look in Townsend's book, Townsend was very much aware of the fact that there was a long tail on the correlation function of the streamwise velocity, very much longer than you expected it to be. The original data was taken by Grant, who was Townsend's student, and Townsend and Grant both published articles on this. And this has gone unexplained since 1957. But Townsend looked at this very long motion and said, well, look, anything that's that long, that's thousands of viscous wall units long, cannot have a very large angle of inclination to the wall. And if it doesn't have a large angle of inclination, it can't have a strong V component. If it doesn't have a strong V component, it can't have a strong UV product, and therefore it can't contribute to the Reynolds shear stress. Right? So he called these the inactive motions, and he said that they played no role in generating turbulent friction. Okay? And he said the main turbulent motion, which are things of say, more like the size of the individual hairpins, was the thing that did the transport, and it was local. So what we've done here, in order to sort of quantify some of the concepts I've been talking about, was to try to analyze the contributions of different scales. And what we find is that if you look at the energy, if you take the first 12 modes of a proper orthogonal decomposition, they contain somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of the turbulent kinetic energy in the streamwise component. Okay? Or, in fact, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong, excuse me. This is turned around here. Excuse me, here, this is the column, pair of columns I want to look at. This is the energy, about 50% for the first 12 modes. But then the interesting thing is if you look at the Reynolds shear stress that is associated with those 12 modes, they contain between two-thirds and three-quarters of the total Reynolds shear stress. So actually, these very large-scale structures, these first 12 modes are all large scales, and they contain more than half of the Reynolds shear stress, which, if you think about turbulence modeling, most turbulence modeling postulates UV to be a function of local variables, but these modes are very long, and they're not local at all. So that could be part of the difficulty in doing Reynolds stress modeling. Okay. That's an interesting thing. I think this idea about the large modes being much more important than anyone appreciated it probably spans many different flows. Right. Yeah.
Where are we?
This is integrated stress. Okay. When you do a POD, you're going to get the integral across the whole channel. Well, in this case, this is a POD in the XY plane, so it's summed over all streamwise and wall normal modes.
But most countries can sum from the
wall. If what I would need to show you is a plot of the fractional contribution as a function of Y, and what happens is that as you get very close to the wall, then the large scale modes contribute less, but they still don't entirely vanish because there are these long streaks close to the wall.
Let Ron finish building.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but I think the reason he was wrong is he had a two-dimensional model. You know, he was thinking of an inclined structure when in fact these things are doing this. They're fully three-dimensional, so they can still not have much inclination and still have significant V. Yeah.
Many people made their living.
Are we done?
I am, if I could conclude.
Gentlemen, I think you should let
Yeah. Okay, so let me just conclude. I think you all know what the conclusions are, but let me just say that I think that the hairpins do exist, and they may not be perfectly symmetric or anything like that. You have to have a liberal interpretation of what hairpin means, but I think they do exist. I think they exist in packets, and I think the formation of the packets is an important aspect of the turbulence that explains heretofore unexplained phenomena. And when you look at the packets as a whole, all these different observations that I began my talk talking about, the Q2, Q4 events, the beta events, the long tail on the correlation curve, all of that is explicable in terms of this relatively simple model. Okay, thank you.
Before we start discussion, let me note a couple of people who came in a little late, Professor Andy Maida, Bassan Dane from UCSB, Mechanical Engineering. I think Bruno and the others walked in a bit late. So those are the people you hadn't met before. I suppose we should have some more discussion on the work that Ron presented. It seems to me some questions do remain unanswered. For instance, what is the relation between the scale of the hairpin structure or the packet of hairpin structures to the thickness of the boundary layer? I think you did not touch upon this issue, although you implied that they sort of grow in generations, so to speak. And I suppose another important question is, now that we know hairpins do exist, how do you build a model build them into a model that I suppose produces the principal effects thereafter, such as, let's say, the shear stress or the drag, something like that.
So there are still lots of questions, I'm sure. I don't know if you would like to comment on those two before you...
Yeah.
Address others.
There's recent work by Maruzic, who has taken these ideas and applied them. You know, Maruzic was Perry's student, and they're, I'd say, the foremost practitioners of synthesizing the statistics of turbulent boundary layers out of vortex models. And Maruzic, you know, incorporated the packet idea and was able to finally explain the structure of the correlation functions in the spectrum that had not been properly explained by their earlier work. As far as prediction of the Reynolds stress, in their earlier work they had some adjustable values and they had been adjusted to give good predictions, but what you do when you have the coherent vortex induction is you have to use some new empirical values for the parameters that describe the vortices, and they give equally good predictions. I think that, you know, conceptually it's important to understand that the outer part of the boundary layer is old and the inner part is young, in terms of understanding non-equilibrium boundary layers, for example.
So what is the relation between the hairpin and the thickness of the boundary layer, for instance?
The thickness of the boundary layer grows quite a bit more slowly than these packets. So I think these packets grow up to a certain point. You notice I was showing them growing up to about 6/10 of the boundary layer thickness. And then something happens, and they break down, and a new packet occurs in front of them. And so I think that whatever happens to cause that breakdown is what ultimately leads to the very slow growth of the boundary layer itself, which is only about a half degree to 1 degree, depending on where you are.
The Utah flow visualization you showed, in which also, you know, I mentioned, the boundary layer thickness is several, say, tens to hundreds of meters, and you have hairpins very trivial in size. So what is your thinking about how they are related?
The picture I showed you, which I'm trying to find, actually the packets there were about 2 meters high and the boundary layer thickness was 200 meters. The reason you saw 2 meter higher vortices is that was all the smoke seeded. All right, but my feeling is that if you seeded for a longer period, or you seeded farther upstream, you'd see much larger hairpins, and I would think that they would go up to something similar to what we see in the lab, which would be, you know, 60% of the boundary layer thickness.
I think I should let others.
May I just make a comment here, though I'm not familiar with the details of these data? I think during the process of journey of the sensing vortex from the wall, continuously kept alive by stretching. And when you stretch more or less in the black region of the profile, stretching is there, so either by or the eventually the setting for the head will not survive. It's quite consistent as to what you are doing. And also the fact that 2 meters versus 200 meters is a pretty large boundary layer. If you take theta, it's probably around 2 meters, is that correct?
Probably.
So this is where you expect, let's just say, the passive part of the boundary layer, the weight region, where I don't think any sustaining structure will be, or any structure will be sustained, so there's no continuation.
I would think that if we have to make bets, because we're in an ignorant state, I'll bet that if you seeded this, you'd see up to 50 or 100 meters, you'd still see vortices. Yeah. It's inherent in the log law that the vorticity is going down as 1 over distance from the wall. So this all gets very weak, and and harder to visualize because of that. The vortices are much harder to visualize, they're much less intense. Yeah.
Any other comments? The superfine data seems to indicate this deviation from the log from 50 to 500. Do you think that's related to the change in structure from?
My interpretation is that you don't see a fully formed hairpin until about 100. In other words, by the time a hairpin forms, it's about 200 viscous wall units tall. Okay. If the log law is a manifestation of self-similarity of the structure and a scaling with Y, then if you don't have self-similar structures, there's no reason to see a log law. So if your first self-similar, if the smallest element in this ladder of self-similar structures forms at Y plus of 100 or 200, that's where you should start to see a log law.
And the lower limit for the log law, if you look at all the data, is in fact not fixed in Reynolds number. It's not fixed in volume. It's a function of Reynolds number. It just increases also as a function of Reynolds number. So it's 30, as people have already said, have always said, only at low Reynolds number. But if you go to higher and higher Reynolds number, the lower bound also is going up and up.
I wouldn't agree with that.
It's
probably about 300 by 100.
Certainly going from 30 to 300 to 500,
I think what we should do is, as Ron said, there are diehards in also others who have only intellectual information, so to speak, with no serious commitment. Can I also we should close the seminar and thank Ron for his very patient if you want to talk to him, of course, he is here today and part of tomorrow, so we can more.
Yeah, we can.